Hi, I want to welcome you to the Barnabas Ministry audio series on spiritual recovery. And this is going to be about the story of the Exodus. We're going to do a couple different lessons on the story of Exodus and what it can really teach us about spiritual abuse and spiritual recovery. And, you know, to be sure, Exodus is really not about spiritual abuse. It's about a much bigger picture of deliverance of God's people. But within the story of Exodus is a story of abuse and a story of really how abuse can happen and many of the dynamics that are there. And it's really kind of eye-opening to see that that the things that happened in Exodus are the same things that happen in unhealthy and abusive churches, and some of the ways that we can address these bad spiritual experiences that we have today are things that we'll see in the book of Exodus. So it's actually pretty eye-opening. So let's go ahead and jump right in there. The first point really is that God led the people there, and he brought great blessings. Now, if we go back into Genesis chapter 45 and verse 8, Joseph says this to his brothers. And of course, you may remember the story of how Joseph ended up in Egypt in the first place through a bunch of bad things being done to him and things like that. So you can go back and look at that later if you like. But here in Genesis 45, verse 8, "So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household, and ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father, Jacob, and say to him, this is what your son Joseph says. God has made me lord of all Egypt. Come down to me. Don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near me, you, your children, and your grandchildren, your flocks and herds, and all you have. I will provide for you here, because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all who belong to you will become destitute." And then, of course, Joseph's brothers take this message back to Jacob, and Jacob isn't so sure what to do about it. Listen to what God says here in Genesis 46 and verse 3. "I am God, the God of your father," he said. "Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back again. And Joseph's own hand will close your eyes." Then in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 6, "Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so the land was filled with them." And you know, the first point to really see about Egypt was that God really brought the people there. And it was a great blessing. And many great blessings happened for the Israelites in Egypt. And of course, there was this famine in the land, and God had provided Joseph with the ability to store up food and provide for all of Egypt. And that's how his brothers ended up there. And that's how the whole nation ended up there. And so he says, come on down here. You're going to be okay. We're going to take care of you. And in fact, Jacob's whole family moved there and prospered there. And a couple of things we can learn from this is that God is really a big God. He's really looking out for things way down the road for us. And it's something to keep in mind when we go through hard times, like dealing with spiritual abuse or tough church situations like that. God's a really big God, and he's on top of stuff like this. Now, I'm pretty convinced that that a lot of churches that go bad, they don't start out bad. In fact, they may start out really good. Egypt started out great for Jacob and for his descendants. I mean, it was great. It was a great place for them to be. They had food. They had peace. They could settle. They multiplied. They lived in a great situation. I mean, it's hard to find anything wrong with that. And, you know, a lot of times when we're looking at a spiritually abusive church or a bad church situation, we think, well, how in the world did I end up here? And gosh, is the whole thing just a big mess? Is it all bad? Not necessarily. Nobody knowingly joins a bad church or an abusive church. But even more than that, a lot of times God will lead us into situations that really do provide a lot of good things and great things for a time. And the problem isn't those great things. The problem is other things that go with it. And it's something good to keep in mind that even though later on in the story, we're going to see it pretty soon here, that the Israelites were having a really tough time in Egypt. Egypt wasn't always that way. And I can look back at bad church situations I've been in, and they weren't always that way. There were good things there. And one of the real key things into healing and recovering from a bad church experience is to recognize the good things that were there. And it's okay to recognize the good things that were there and the good times and the good things that God did. And keep that in mind. But of course, we do know that the story of Egypt does go bad for the Israelites. And so let's keep on reading. In Exodus chapter 1 and verse 8, "Then a new king who did not know about Joseph came to power in Egypt. 'Look,' he said to his people, 'the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country.'" This is one of the most bizarre verses in the whole book of Exodus. I mean, I can only think of one other verse that's more bizarre than this, because there's so many things stated here that just are incredible. And let's pull this apart a little bit here. The first thing is, okay, we have a new king who did not know about Joseph. What kind of person becomes a king of a country and doesn't know the history of his country? Really? I mean, you got to be kidding me. And yet, that's what's happening here. And I'm not questioning the authenticity or the correctness of the scripture. I'm saying, how bizarre is it that you have a guy running a country that doesn't know about the history of the country? You know, it's always bad to be ignorant of history. And one of the problems that Protestantism has, frankly, is a lack of history. A lot of times people just want to erase the bad history in Protestantism. And history begins when the church building was built, or when the new pastor got hired, or when some new program came into place. And everything that happened before that just didn't really happen. And that's just ridiculous. You've got to learn some church history, not just from a collective sense of, you know, from the beginning, you know, from the time of the apostles all the way through until now, but even a current church history of congregations and where these churches came from, what ideas drive them, what gave rise to those ideas, what is it that they're trying to do, etc. And when you start looking at church, at a current church situation through a little bit of a historical prism, you'll start seeing, oh, okay, that's why that's that way. Okay, I understand it now. But if you never know the history, you're going to end up doing bizarre things. Well, here you've got a leader who does bizarre things. And you know, look at the stated concern he says. He says he doesn't want the Israelites to leave the country. And this means that there was a mutual benefit for them being there. So he likes having the Israelites there. He doesn't want them to leave. But he says they're too numerous. Well, wait a minute. You want them, but you don't want more of them. Isn't that kind of a hard thing to reconcile? I mean, if the Israelites have been there for generations and have prospered mutually with the Egyptians, they've shared in the blessings that God provided to that land. So they hadn't done any of the things that this king was afraid of up to this time. Why would they do it now? It just doesn't make any sense. And honestly, does anyone believe that this idea that he comes up with even advances his objective? Okay, suppose you've got free people living in Egypt, and they're carrying on business and living their lives and enjoying the blessings of God there. But now you're going to enslave them, and they're going to be less likely to fight for your enemies after you enslave them. Are you kidding me? If you enslave them, they're going to be more eager to fight for your enemies. It's just completely convoluted. And one of the things we're going to see over and over again when you deal with a totalitarian, abusive situation is a lot of times they cause the very things they claim they're trying to prevent. And I don't know if it's some kind of a big cosmic joke, almost, that life works out that way. But we're going to see it over and over again, that they cause the very things they claim they want to fix. So he says, okay, let's deal shrewdly with them. And this is always the great excuse to build these totalitarian, control-oriented, abusive systems. They'll say, well, you know, like the king of Egypt, well, it's for the good of the country. Or somebody might say, well, it's for the good of the church. It's for the good of the kingdom. It's for the good of this. It's for the good of that. And so there's always some good that supposedly justifies doing things that don't seem so good. And let me ask you a question. Is taking away God-given freedom good? Does a good person take away freedom? Is that something a good person would do? And yet there's always the do-gooders out there that think, if I can control everything, I'll make it better. And I think that's how they try to present it to people. Oh, love, give me control. Put me in charge, and I'll make everything better. And really, all they want is the control and the power. They don't have the ability to make things better. And that's the big lie that goes on at this. But it's always presented in a way, oh, it's for the good of the country, for the good of the church. And I saw more abusive things done in abusive churches that were, quote-unquote, for the good of the church. You know, and when there were issues that come up, you'll hear people say things like, well, let's do what's best for the church. You know what? How about you do what's right? How about you do what the scriptures say to do instead of what's best for the church? Because what's best for the church becomes this little subjective thing now. And people can justify doing all kinds of bizarre things, quote unquote, for the good of the church. How about you do what's right? How about you do what the scriptures say to do? How about you do what's ethical? And what's fair, and what treats people with respect, with what do the things that honor freedom that God gives to people. So when you hear people saying stuff like, well, we're going to do what's best for the church, or help us understand what's best for the church, watch out. Because what they ought to be doing is, well, let's do what's right. Help us to pray to help us figure out what's really the right thing to do in a situation. But, you know, these people, they present these things in ways that They try to make it seem like it's so smart and so brilliant. And if you don't think it's smart or brilliant, well, you're just not spiritual enough to understand how smart and brilliant it really is. Or you're just not experienced enough. You're just not wise enough. Or you're just not good enough to understand how wise and brilliant all these things are. Well, you know what? Fool me once, shame on me. Or, you know, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Okay? I can understand where young people fall for that. Old people should never fall for that. Older people. And I'm saying, man, if you're over 30, you shouldn't be falling for that anymore. When people tell you something that doesn't seem very brilliant, and they just tell you, well, trust me, and it's going to work out okay. Well, I'm not so sure about that. But, you know, these totalitarian systems, they always act like they're so wise and so brilliant. And the funny thing is they always cause the thing they say they want to prevent. And we're going to see that as we go along here. So let's pick up the story again in verse 11. So in Exodus 1, verse 11, so they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. Ha, 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 Pharaoh. So that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar, and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. So here we see that we've got slave masters in charge of the people now. Now, when the Israelites were in Egypt, and the scriptures don't really tell us, and you know there might be some historical research we could do to figure out what was going on there more, but it seems like everybody pretty much knew that the Israelites were aliens in Egypt. Doesn't seem like they really assimilated, that they pretty much kept to themselves or kept separate, but they obviously interacted enough to do business and to prosper because the king said he didn't want them to leave. So it looks like there's a lot of interaction there, but they're still separate. But they, you know, according to being aliens, there were probably some restrictions or some considerations there anyway. But here you see the first real sneaky thing that comes up. He gets slave masters. And I'm going to come back to this point many times through discussing this in the story of Exodus because it fits over and over. No abusive system can function without middlemen. And the key thing about these middlemen is that their consciences are free to do what they're told. And they can treat other people badly because that's what they've been told to do. And when you've got middlemen who can treat people bad or treat them badly and say, well, I'm just doing what I was told to do, it's devastating. Because these people have no problem in their conscience with doing all the hurtful things they do to others. Because they can say, well, it's just, I'm doing what I was told to do. I'm trusting that the Pharaoh that told me that if I do this, the country's going to be better off. I'm trusting that, so I'm doing his part. I'm doing what he told me to do. It's not my fault. And we can excuse ourselves. You'll see things along these lines that are appeals to unity. Well, we all need to get involved with this plan. We all need to get behind the plan because the leaders put it in place. And we all need to be doing this. We all need to stick to the plan. Let me tell you something. Being united in stupidity or evil is not a virtue. Okay, unity is not a virtue. Unity is neutral. You can be united in doing something great. You can be united in doing something terrible. So what if you're united? So what? And yet so many of these totalitarian-type groups, control-oriented groups, abusive groups, one of the most important criterias that they drag out is unity. And they try to trick people into doing bad things and stupid things and hurtful things and misdirected things all under the guise of unity. And you got to watch out for that. And what ends up happening is that the plan that the leadership puts in place ends up becoming more authoritative than Scripture and more authoritative than God, because now you're bound to be united. You must do what everyone else is doing. You must do what you're being told to do. And if the Scriptures are saying to do something else, or if doing right is different than that, then all of a sudden you've got a choice. Oh, do I do what's right or what the Scriptures say, or do I do what I'm being told to do and be united? Well, the trick here is that being united is not a virtue, and you got to realize that. Let's look at the ultimate results here of what happens. And this is just a kind of a short-term thing. I mean, we're only in a couple verses describing this slavery. In verse 12, the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied. Ha, ha, ha. You wanted to cut down the population of Israel? Well, guess what? They're growing more. In verse 12, it says the Egyptians dreaded them. And what you see here now, instead of a united nation prospering together, you see a ruling class and a slave class. And there's a sense of panic among the Egyptians now. Oh my gosh, why in the world did we do this? We've damaged these people, we've hurt these people, we've enslaved them, we're treating them terribly, and it's not working. The plan's not working. They're prospering, they're multiplying. What do we do now? And you get the sense of panic. Well, the sense of panic, we're going to see what that brings. And it, believe me, it's not good. In verse 13, it says they were ruthless. They treated them ruthlessly. And, you know, it's really interesting to watch noble leaders with noble objectives in these totalitarian-type systems, how ruthless they become to implement their, quote-unquote, noble vision or their good vision. It's really instructive, because when they present these things, oh, it's for the good of the nation, the good of the people, blah, blah, blah. Watch how ruthless they become in implementing their plan. There's no grace. There's no leeway. There's nothing but oppression and control driving these things. You do it and you shut up or else. And we're going to see what happens with the or else later on here too. Okay, but the thing you got to see here, and it's right here in the Scriptures, they start treating these people ruthlessly. Once you open the door to mistreating people, where does it end? It just takes off, and you can't stop it. When you cross the line of doing something wrong for some greater objective, where's the limit to that? Where's the limit? If I could enslave somebody for a greater good, and it doesn't achieve the greater good, well, let's go ahead and beat them. Let's kill a few of them. What's going to cause someone to stop doing evil that good might result? And see, once you open the door to this kind of harshness and control and abuse, there's no end to it. But what happens is these groups tend to pour it on thicker to try to save the movement, to try to save the system. And of course, all it does is make things worse. And the sad thing is that there's a lot of people that get hurt while it's being made worse. Well, in verse 14, it says that they made the lives bitter of the people. And boy, I tell you, there aren't too many topics that'll get me on a soapbox quicker than talking about bitterness. Bitterness comes from being treated wrongly. Abusive leaders want to turn around and use the bitterness of their victims to control them. Oh, you're bitter. You're just bitter. And they try to make people seem like they're sinners or they're evil or they're subhuman or they're not good Christians because they're angry or bitter about how they've been mistreated. And, you know, it's ridiculous. It's like killing somebody and then blaming them for being dead. The one that caused the bitterness is the one who's at fault, not the one who's bitter. And yet in abusive churches, the one who causes the bitterness has the microphone. And they're the ones who go around saying, oh, you're just bitter. You're bitter. You need to repent of your bitterness. And everybody just sits there like a bunch of brainless sheep going, oh, yeah, we shouldn't be bitter. We shouldn't be bitter. Wait a minute. Who caused the bitterness? Who caused it? Isn't that where the problem is? And, you know, the great thing about this verse, there's not a word in it about God condemning the Israelites for being bitter. In fact, we're going to see that bitterness is part of God's plan later on. We're going to see that pretty soon here. But God doesn't get on the people for being bitter. Bitterness is what happens when you're treated badly. And it really does serve a purpose. So don't let one of these do-gooder, control freak, totalitarian, abusive spiritual leader guys get on your case about being bitter. Okay, because bitterness comes from being treated badly. Now in verse 14 it says that they used them. And really, that's the heart of abuse. They used them. Instead of saying, we are here for each other, or I am here for you, the spiritual abuser says, you are here for me. I am going to use you. You exist for me. And that's the heart of abuse right there. And again, it's not right. It's wrong. And yet there it is very plainly in the book of Exodus how the Israelites went from prospering in Egypt to being subjugated and being mistreated. In just a few verses, and it's like, wow, that's how it happens. And it applies to our lives today. Well, the next thing that you're going to see going on in a spiritually abusive system, and we see it here in Egypt, is that they eliminate the strong who might oppose them. So let's look in verse 15 of Exodus 1. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live. But the midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. Well, this is where totalitarianism leads you. It's not good enough to just enslave people and oppress them and make their lives bitter. Now we're going to kill them. We're going to kill the boys. The problem is Pharaoh's painted himself into a corner here, and he may not even know it yet. Okay, if he lets the boys live, they're going to grow up to fight the slave masters and overthrow Pharaoh. If he kills the boys, the entire race of the Hebrews is going to come to an end. So there's going to be no one there to carry on. Girls can't have babies on their own. And so he wanted the Hebrews, but now he's going to end them. He's going to end the race. He's painted himself into a corner, and now he's desperate. And he resorts to killing babies. Think about that. He didn't say that at the beginning to the people. Oh, we got to deal shrewdly. Let's kill all the boys. No, he just wanted to subjugate them and enslave them. But now this thing is out of control. And, you know, the thing going on here that you got to be aware of, abusive churches are usually very image conscious. And they're always very careful to present the good things that they say they're doing very, very straightforwardly, you know, in the videos and the hype and slick presentations and all this. But you get underneath the layer of all the presentations and you'll be sickened by how much unbelievable bad behavior there is towards other people. And it can be pretty scary. It can be pretty bad. But here's Pharaoh down here, down to killing babies. And of course he gets some middleman to do it. He tries to get these midwives to do it. And then when they don't do it, he tells the whole nation to do it. He says, gave this order to all the people. Every boy that is born, throw him in the Nile. Of course, he doesn't have the guts to do that himself. So he tells other people to do it. In spiritually abusive churches, conformity to the system is paramount. If you ever have anything breaking the system or not following the system, the whole thing falls apart. So this is why there's this big push for unity and everybody doing the same thing, conformity. They've got you enforce that, because if there's any cracks in that, the whole thing's going to fall apart. It's going to be like the emperor's new clothes, and people are going to say, hey, this is stupid. So you can't even tolerate any kind of objections or disagreements or disputes or anything like that. Well, the first corollary of mandating this conformity is that you can't tolerate opposition. And so what you'll see happening in a lot of these abusive churches, that people that come into the church aren't really just converted to Christ. They have to be converted to be submissive to the system and to the leaders. It's no longer good enough just to be a Christian and to be faithful to Christ. Now they have to sign on to being obedient to the leaders. And I'm not saying you come into a church and just, you know, tell the leaders to go blow every time you get a chance. I'm not talking about that, but there's a level of control in submitting to a system and leaders that is expected as a condition of church membership. And it lends itself to abuse. Because what happens is anytime anything comes up where this loyalty or submission is in question, the leaders are going to pounce on it because they know the whole system is at stake. So if you don't do what you're told, if you question anything about it, you're ripe to be confronted and challenged and brought back into the fold right now or else, because they can't tolerate anybody going off the reservation on these kind of things. And there can even be little tests. If they think somebody might be straying a little bit, well, they'll give them a little test and see if they take the bait and see if they'll do something that's a little bit outside of what's expected, and then they'll come down hard on them for doing it. And of course, under the guise, this is all presented under the guise of discipleship. We should all be learners. We should all be disciples and learn from those who have more experience than us and who know better than us. And so we're supposed to learn all these things. Well, that sounds great, but here's the thing. Real learners eventually learn and grow up and become peers with the people that taught them. But in abusive systems, people never outgrow dependency upon the leader. they are always subject to it. They never grow up. And let me tell you something. Something that's true and right, it can always withstand questioning. Truth can always stand up to being questioned. You don't have to say, just shut up and do it. Or this is what we've decided to do and you need to be united. If it's really true, if it's really right, if it's really wise, it will always stand up to questioning. But in these abusive systems, submission is the cardinal virtue. And that will be held up as the virtue. It's no longer about being a godly person or a faithful person or following God's plan for your life. It all becomes about the system, the movement, the vision, the dream, whatever is being used to present or sell these ideas to the congregation. That's what it becomes about. And if you get out of line, you might find yourself thrown into the river. Metaphorically speaking, hopefully not literally. But they may run you out. They may mistreat you, marginalize you. They'll question your heart. They'll say you're not really a disciple. They'll question your salvation. They'll make subtle remarks that so-and-so is not doing well. Well, what do you mean they're not doing well? Oh, they disagree with the leadership. Oh, they object to mistreatment of other people. Oh, they're not doing well. And there's all kinds of subtle ways to throw somebody into the river in abusive systems. And what they do is it's either you're in or you're out. You're either with it or you're not. And of course, they try to twist things that Jesus said, where he says, you know, you're either with me or against me. Let me tell you what, church leaders aren't Jesus. Okay, there's a big difference. And if we have to explain it, we're in trouble. This heartless, ruthless, relentless pursuit of control is what totalitarian spiritual systems lead spiritual leaders to do. When you see this cold-hearted, single-minded pursuit of control and authority, even to the point of disposing of people, you know you're in an abusive system. And it always amazed me how hard people would work to win converts, but then how quickly they would be discarded if that convert rejected the control. Or even somebody who was a leader, who somebody turns around and says, you know, we're treating people wrongly here. We're doing the wrong things. We're hurting people. We're doing more harm than good. All of a sudden, oh, they're evil. And then they're written out of history. Anything good that they ever did never happened anymore. It's amazing. These systems cannot stand anybody who challenges the system. And you'll see this played out. But again, we see it in the book of Exodus. We see where it starts. They cannot tolerate opposition. So they want you to be strong, but not too strong. What they really mean is they want you to be strong for them. Now, let's come back to the middlemen here. Again, as I was saying before, the middlemen are critical to the whole system. They're the ones that make it work, because Pharaoh can't possibly control the whole nation. He needs these middlemen. The middlemen are the ones that do the real dirty work. They're eager to prove themselves, well, I'm a real disciple. I'm real loyal. I'm totally in the system. I'm united. I'm faithful. I'm doing exactly what the leader says to do. And so they're the ones who enforce the control everywhere else. And they're held up and praised as real great examples and all this kind of stuff. But here's a couple of middlemen or middle women that say, you know what, we're not doing the wrong thing. You want me to kill the boys? Go pound sand, Pharaoh. I'm not doing it. And they even answer Pharaoh very shrewdly. Oh, the women, the Hebrew women give birth before the midwives get there. I'm not so sure that wasn't a little bit dishonest. But God doesn't have a problem with it. He's okay with telling somebody who's spiritually abusive something that may not be totally true to make them back off. It's pretty amazing. You know, and to be a middleman in an abusive system can be tough, because on one hand you think, oh, I believe in the system, I'm going to enforce everything and I'm going to make it work. Well, the middleman is usually one of the first people to figure out that this does not work, that treating people badly doesn't work. And I think middlemen go through stages where, okay, at first they're really loyal and into the whole thing and all that. Then they start seeing, well, I'm not so sure about this. But what they find themselves doing is trying to be a nice guy to the people they are in charge of, but they still have to answer to a tyrant and speak the tyrant's language when they're speaking with him. And so they kind of end up getting it from both sides. And being a middleman in these systems without confronting the problem is a really painful thing to do. But of course, you're conditioned to not confront the problem, and you're not allowed to confront the problem. So it lives inside of all the middlemen, and it eats them up. They're trying to do the right things for everybody, and eventually they just got to say, you know what, this is crazy. Well, the funny thing about that, if you're a middleman who's always trying to make the leader look good to the people that you lead, and you're protecting them from their harshness, someday you're going to say, you know what, Pharaoh's harsh. Pharaoh's mean. Pharaoh's oppressive. Pharaoh's a jerk. And then those people are going to say, no, you're the jerk. Because you've been telling us Pharaoh's been a great guy all along. And we should all just go with the plan. But when you cover for an abuser, and then you finally tell the truth, there's a pretty good likelihood that you're going to be the one who's going to be disliked because you covered for the abuser. Because I've experienced that personally. And it happens. But the middleman is in a tough spot because he's the one who sees, first and foremost, this is ridiculous. This can't continue. I've got to do something about this. And it goes beyond the scope of what we can do in a class here to talk about what your options might be. But the middleman's there. Let me just tell you, it takes a lot of guts to be a righteous middleman in a system, because you're going to be the one who has to stand up and say, this is bogus. This isn't working. And you're going to get the whole pain of it on you. And that's a great place to leave our lesson here, because our next lesson will be about Moses. And we're going to talk about Moses and how he confronts the system and what goes on with him. So anyway, that's the end of part one of our discussion about Egypt, and I'll talk to you next time.